My name is Ed Goldberg, and I'm speaking with Carol Casella. Carol, welcome to Portland. Welcome to KABU.
Thank you, Ed. I'm happy to be here.
Well, happy to have you. The title of your book is Healer, not like a dog, but like a physician healer.
Right, with the A.
Yeah. Your last name is spelled C-A-S-S-E-L-L-A, and Simon & Schuster. How's Carly these days? I understand she's related to that family.
Oh, you know, they never tell me. I hope she's well.
I hope she's well also, yeah. And if you ever see her, ask her, what's that song really about Warren Beatty?
I will. I'm sure she's never been asked that before.
Oh, never before.
No.
I can see right away this is going to be fun. We start diverging and tangenting right away. I'm going to read a little paragraph about you. Carol is a practicing anesthesiologist. You still work as a physician?
I do.
Uh-huh. And novelist. You were a closet writer for years before you decided to blend medicine and fiction. I usually get those in bills, medicine and fiction. You know. Your first novel was titled Oxygen, also Simon & Schuster, story of an anesthesiologist tangled in the aftermath of an operating room catastrophe. Oy. Grew up in Dallas and graduated from Duke with a degree in English Lit.
Yeah.
And then you became a doctor anyway. Okay. But you worked in publishing for a while. That's right. Okay. You now live on Bainbridge Island, and you liked it, eh?
I do. I like Bainbridge.
It's a beautiful place. And you have two sets of twins.
That's
twins
right.
Run in your family?
No, they don't. No. They were out of the blue. Well, you know, we all know where they come from.
Where they come from, yes.
Yeah, but the first set were fraternal, and I was a little bit older when I had them, so I had a higher risk of fraternal twinning. It's hard to apply risk to, you know, two babies.
Two babies, yeah.
And then the second set were surprised identical twins, identical girls. So,
It's interesting to me that you have, how old are your girls?
I have three girls. So I have one 15-year-old, two 14-year-olds, and one 15-year-old boy.
Oy.
Yep. I know. It's a lot of hormones in that household.
I'm telling you. And there's a girl, a 14-year-old girl in the book named Jory. And
yes.
I'm saying to myself, well, now I know where she got all the medical stuff from. She didn't have to do a whole lot of research on the medical stuff. But I wonder if she's got kids this age, because this kid sounds real. So, all right, let's set this up. We're talking about a family, Claire, Jory, and Addison, the husband. And they're... this is a whole book about lowered expectations in a way.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Addison is a really, really smart guy who had a biotech firm that had a really, really hot product, and suddenly he was brought down by a bad lab test.
Right.
They lose everything. They lose their big house in Seattle. They lose everything, pretty much. And they're forced to live in what was supposed to be their little vacation home. Why don't you set that up a little bit for us?
Sure. Claire and Addison and, before Jory, marry when they are both young and don't have particularly great means. And then Addison, who's working as a biotech pharmaceutical researcher, develops a blood test for ovarian cancer and makes a fortune almost overnight. And around the same time, Claire delivers a preterm child. So she's in her family practice residency, and she drops out to take care of her baby. And then, partly because they have all this money and because she has this child, she doesn't go back. But then 14 years later, when Addison is working on a cancer drug, the studies go wrong at the last minute. He's invested too much of his own skin in the drug, and the family's finances are basically collapsed overnight. So essentially what I've tried to do is show a family that grew up loving one another without the idea of money being any part of it. And then after living 15 years with a lot of money, when it's suddenly taken away, how do they have to redefine themselves? What do they have to rediscover and learn that money did to them that they weren't even aware of?
It hits Jory the hardest initially because, there are reasons that it hits Claire hard as well because of things that her husband hasn't told her. Maybe, I don't know if you want to talk about that or not, but
sure.
I'll let you do that. But
sure.
Jory she's lost her friends. She's lost his big, beautiful house in Seattle. She's lost her ballet lessons. She's lost pretty much everything. They even have to put a satellite dish on the roof to get internet in this place. They ain't got no money, and she's never lived her whole life without no money.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you want to talk about what Addison did with their money?
Sure, yeah. I follow actually the true path that a drug might take through development from a small biopharmaceutical company like Addison is running. And Addison, he's a good man. He really believes deeply that this drug that he's discovered could potentially make a huge difference in the treatment of cancer in this country, in any country. So he invests more and more and more of it and gets closer and closer to the point at which he would get approval, the drug might be purchased. But he takes too much of a risk, and finally things turn south. They own this land out in eastern Washington that they'd always intended to redevelop. They were going to tear down the house and build a new one. It's got this old decrepit farmhouse on it. But now there's no money to do that. So Claire has to revive her medical career to support the family, and she takes Jory out to eastern Washington while Addison tries to find new investors. And one of the things that was interesting to me as a mother, especially writing this, is realizing that for all that I try, I think we all try to teach our children and tell our children about values and what money means and how difficult it is to get money and how appreciative we need to be. That's sometimes a lesson you can only learn through living. And it's really difficult when you're living in a decent suburb to help your children understand how many people have nothing. So suddenly Jory is, as you said, ripped out of her comfortable life and sort of stuck in this place where she has to learn this overnight. And it dramatically affects her relationship with her parents and her sense of identity. And Claire simultaneously has to go back and support the family now, return to a field that she had left 14 years earlier, almost forgotten how to practice. So I think suddenly stripping them of money takes them all to a place they hadn't expected to be.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I read this book, I kept thinking everything in here is a metaphor for something, or is supposed to be projected onto a world. What you've done is taken something that bothers you, you see as a real problem, and personalized it with a little family of three, taking it pretty much down to the most basic family unit. Is there something writ larger here? Is there something you were thinking of that everybody here represents?
Yeah, well, to me there is. And some readers will see it and some readers won't. And I hope that doesn't matter when you're reading the book.
It doesn't matter.
But to me, one reason that I chose a family that had started sort of middle class and then becomes very wealthy and then goes back to being what might be in terms of income lower middle class, so they're certainly not destitute. It doesn't represent the worst story that we've seen during this economic crisis, where people who were doing all right, were getting by, suddenly are stripped of everything. They're living in their cars. And I could have told that story, but that would have been a very different emotional story. What I wanted to do was tell what I thought was the story of this country, where we had grown to this point where we didn't even recognize the excess that we had. The money we spend on things we don't really need became so easy that I think we kind of forgot what it was to live on a more sustainable level. And that's one reason that I chose to make it these particular shifts in income level.
Well, I want people to know this is not a screed or, you know, a tendentious political document. You did this as a real human story. And is Hallam a fictional town?
It's a fictional town, but it's based largely on some of the small towns in the Okanagan Valley. Mm-hmm. And to return to your first question, too, very coincidentally, my own family went through much of what Claire's family went through. My husband is in real estate and construction and basically lost his job in this. And suddenly I was sort of living Claire's life, which gave it a sense of emotional realism. I almost wish I didn't have the opportunity to put into it.
But I actually have that in my notes. Ask if there's any personal relationship to the story. Because I hate to personalize it for myself, but Forty-five years ago, my uncle had a very, very successful business that suddenly started to go south, and then started to throw more and more money into it, borrowing money, and then died of a heart attack at the age of 51. And when my aunt went to collect the insurance, she discovered that he had sold his life insurance to throw it into the business, and so she had nothing. She had nothing. And even the house that they lived in, they had fixed up way past their middle-class neighborhood, so they were never going to be able to get any money out of it that they put into it. But they thought they were going to be there the rest of their lives. So when I read this, I said, oh, my God, you know, this is like my Uncle Murray and my Aunt Kitty. This is just what happened to them. And fortunately, Addison doesn't die, but otherwise that's it.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of stories out there like that. And, I mean, it's human nature, and maybe it's even a wise decision sometimes to live for the moment. And we're always balancing that. Do you save your money or do you spend it and enjoy yourself today? And we're all juggling that, but I think maybe we got into a cycle where we were doing it perhaps a little too much.
Let me talk about some of the other characters in the book. I mean, this book would be a different book without Dan Zelaya in it, of course.
Yeah.
When Claire decides that she is going to try to apply for a job as a doctor, she has two things going against her. One, she hasn't done doctoring in 14 years.
Right.
And two, she's not board certified. So she pretty much has to take whatever she can get. I mean, if it turns out to be, you know, emptying bedpans as an orderly in the hospital, she might have to take that. But miracle of miracles, she finds a clinic. Tell us about Dan Zelaya.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Dan Zelaya is an older man in his 70s who is the son of some immigrants who came in from Mexico a long time ago. And he's worked as a physician throughout the country, throughout the world, really, with his wife, Evelyn. And now in his later retirement years, he started a volunteer clinic in the Okanagan Valley, or a place like that, to take care of a lot of the migrant farm workers who work in that area, as well as many of the uninsured or low-income people in that area. And there are clinics like that. This was modeled after a clinic that started in that area. It was later absorbed into the community health clinic system that we have now. And I worked in a migrant farm workers clinic at one point in my life, and it's great work. It's really, really wonderful to take care of people who don't always have another option. And it does teach you a completely different approach to medical care, because you can no longer just fling dollars at every problem. You really have to think carefully about what you're going to spend money on, what drugs you're going to prescribe, what tests you're going to do, because the money's not infinite.
Let me ask you about that. One of the things that struck me about this is medicine the way it does before there were things like MRIs, before there were these endless lab tests and electronic machines and all that kind of stuff. Very little of this kind of medical care is going on in the United States anymore, except maybe in clinics like this. Do you know do you know what the prevalence is of hands-on doctoring anymore in this country? Is there a hook on that somewhere?
Well, it's happening a lot more in small clinics like this. And if you go out to rural cities in this country, rural towns, you will find a lot of clinics like this that are being run on shoestrings and trying to juggle. And they either don't have access to a lot of the tests. They certainly don't have the money for the tests. But my own opinion is that we have, I think, one of the problems with our healthcare system, one of the reasons we're in a financial crisis with it, is because we've kind of invented ourselves beyond what we can afford. An MRI is a great way to diagnose knee pain, but can we afford to do that on every sore knee? Well, we can't. But how are we going to decide who gets it, who doesn't? It's a tough problem.
Like I said, this book is a metaphor for a lot of things. So, yeah. I'd like to remind our listeners I'm speaking with Carol Casella. The title of her book is Healer, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. Great diagnosticians, it is said, can smell disease.
Yeah.
That when a doctor walks into an examination room, they can sometimes, by the appearance and aroma of a patient, tell what's wrong with them. Is that true?
Well, to a degree, that's true. To a degree, it is. I actually had a doctor when I was in training in internal medicine who, for patients with pneumonia, could do a pretty good job of diagnosing what they were infected with by smelling their breath. Wasn't the most pleasant task, but it was great to train.
But it was cheap.
Yeah, it was cheap, and it's a great illustration of how important it is to touch patients and be in contact, really listen to patients. And another thing I think that's happened is we've gotten more technology and more diagnostic tools through blood tests, through laboratories, through imaging studies. We do a lot less of that. Medical students learn a lot less of that, how to just touch, listen through a stethoscope instead of doing an echocardiogram.
Yeah, that's a shame, because I think there are studies now that tell us that a doctor simply laying hands on a patient and sitting next to them at the bedside and talking to them in a calm voice does more for a patient's outlook and possibly even for their cure than throwing them in a damn cold room and telling them, okay, you have to lay still for half an hour while somebody bangs a hammer over your head.
Okay,
there's no question there, I understand.
Yeah, I know, but I know what you mean. And, you know, we're discovering, too, hospitals are kind of dangerous places to be.
That's too bad. Let me ask you about something. There's little things in here. First of all, have your kids read the book?
No, they haven't read the book yet.
Uh-huh. Okay, so, Mom, we're not like that, are we?
I'm not going to force it on them. I'm hoping they don't identify with Jory too
closely. Jory's a great kid. She's just 14.
You know, she is. And she's at that stage where her social world is so important to her. And when you take that away from a child at that age, abruptly, without choice, it's a hard thing to go through. To some degree, I mean, what she's doing is reflecting what the adults would do if they were allowed to say what they feel.
Mm-hmm. So, oh yeah, that's that screaming id inside all of us that, you know, when it's untrammeled, it's a 14-year-old kid. So,
right.
Yeah. Also, you've made a couple of choices in this book I found very amusing. You make constant references to the Bill Withers song, Ain't No Sunshine When She's Gone. What's up with that?
Good question. You know, that's one of those things that sort of comes to you as a writer. I was on a run. I was listening to some music, and I heard that song, and I just love the song. I always have. And started counting the I knows and thought, that could be a cool link between a couple. To use that song as the what sort of first sparked their relationship and then be able to refer back to it. And that's a bit of a writing tool that you'll have talismans that you come back to periodically. Mm-hmm. But I like to do it with music because music has so many emotional connections with all of us. And we all have songs that we remember that we know will keep with us the rest of our lives. So.
Well, when that song was frequently on the radio, I liked it when I first heard it, like the first 50 times I heard it, and then eventually I started to throw things at the radio when it came on. You know, it
just which I know made you throw the 13th or the 25th.
you counted 26 iterations of I Know in that song. Is that right?
Yes. And I had to listen to it a lot to be able to actually count them, get it right.
You need to get some kind of a medal for that, I'm sure. But all I can say is it could have been worse. It could have been Horse with No Name.
So that's true.
Yeah. This clinic, there is a – the people that come into this clinic have nothing. It's mostly migratory workers. There are other poor people who come in, but it's mostly Mexican migratory workers, mm-hmm. Or Nicaraguan in some cases. Mm-hmm. And they I'm not even sure what they're expecting. I guess they're expecting just not to be thrown out in the street and taken seriously. Is that true?
Mm-hmm. And we have very few places, really, where people with no insurance and no connection to the medical system can go when they do get sick. So to have a walk-in clinic where people come in and they know and learn through word of mouth through the community that they can get the care they need or at least get someone to give them some guidance without necessarily giving up their identity, their papers, where they'll be protected, and they won't necessarily have to pay is a huge thing. Because, of course, ultimately, someone in our country, anyone in our country who comes into an emergency room with a life-threatening disease, our emergency rooms are obligated morally to take care of them and legally. So if we can prevent diseases from getting to that stage by taking care of things earlier, it's really more cost-effective anyway.
Yeah, but the thing is that if you have to go into the emergency room of a major hospital, you're worried that La Migrag's going to come through the front door and put you on the first bus back to Mexico. Is that true? Is that literally true that the physicians have to report whether you're a citizen or not?
I don't believe physicians have to report that. I asked a number of physicians working in emergency rooms out in this area, and well, here they're everywhere. Mm-hmm. They are not, as far as I know, legally required, and I don't know any physicians who would do that. And generally, the police and ICE are careful about not patrolling that area. However, anytime these days, of course, someone without the right papers moves into the public sphere, into any kind of official sphere, there's that concern, there's that worry.
I know a couple of doctors who would do that. The United States Senate, as a matter of fact. I don't want to get too political here, so...
Delicate issue.
Well,
you got to do that.
You know, it's really not such a delicate issue. The idea that someone may or may not have committed a crime to get into this country is irrelevant to the fact that they're sick and need to be helped. But that's just me. Okay.
Yeah.
Ron Walker. Ron Walker is he's a metaphor also, besides being a character in your book. tell us about Ron Walker.
Sure. I'm tempted to tell you about the whole evolution of Ron Walker.
Well, please do. We have a few minutes left.
Well, he started in my mind when I was beginning this book as a rather dark character with some very consciously nefarious ideas and ways to take advantage of the pharmaceutical money, the billions and billions of dollars that flow through that industry. And as I did more research and looked more deeply into it, I realized I didn't want to tell a black and white story like that. I didn't want clearly evil, clearly good people, because people aren't that way. People are, for the most part, gray. We have good parts, we have bad parts, we make good decisions, we make bad decisions. So to me, Ron kind of represents the power of and the influence of money, both for the good and for the not so good. And in particular, within the pharmaceutical drug development line, where we come up with some great drugs that save a lot of lives. And we also have seen some mistakes made, trespasses on conflict of interest that have made people a lot of money and put patients at risk, harmed patients. And both sides of that story are true. So.
Yeah, there's a New York Times this morning. There's a story about GlaxoSmithKline getting an enormous fine, not nearly big enough, mind you, but hundreds of millions of dollars for bogus drugs and tainted drugs. And this is a major world pharmaceutical company.
It is. It's amazing. And they also contribute huge amounts of drugs to the developing world. And they've been behind the development of some of the major big cancer drugs like Gleevec, which is mentioned in my book. Mm-hmm. So there you have it, you know, perfect example of how money can at times influence decisions that take us in the wrong direction, certainly take them in the wrong direction. On the other hand, there's good to be done. So, you know, we've got to look at the whole issue.
Yeah, I was very happy that you made Ron Walker a more complex character than just, you know, Snidely Whiplash with a twirling his mustachios and wondering how he could screw people out of more money. But the thing about him is that he's insulated from the consequences of his actions by several layers of bureaucracy and by having shadow companies doing things. When you created that, I think you clearly had a true model that you based it on.
Definitely. That was based very much on research all the way right up the line, emailing OSHA and not OSHA. I'm sorry. The FDA, branches of the FDA that are in control of drug development and design. And everything that occurs in the book could occur. It's has occurred. It's set up in a way that you are potentially able to have a financial interest in both the ethical research of whether a drug study is going well and being done humanely and making a profit on selling that drug based on the outcome of those studies. How is that not a conflict?
Yeah, I'm a hero on that one.
Answer me.
Yeah. Hey, I'm doing the questioning here. One of the things I really liked about this book is that it poses more questions than it answers.
Oh, good.
What you're doing here is you're actually, if people read this book with any kind of open mind, they will be forced to confront issues that they may not ever even think about. Was that in your plan right from the beginning?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I've just always hated books that wrap everything up neatly. They feel good when you read them and then you promptly forget them. At least I do. Because that's not how life goes. Is it ever wrapped up? As soon as you wrap up one problem, another one opens up.
If it's not already there.
And I think the best thing an author can do for the audience, in addition to some education and a lot of entertainment, you need to entertain people and keep them interested. But you want to make people think. I want to make people think. I want to raise questions that leave them pondering and looking at the world perhaps with a new question in their mind.
Yeah, there's one, again, you know, one hates to use the term metaphor again, but metaphorically, there's a character in here, and I won't mention who it is, who is flown back to Nicaragua because flying her back to Nicaragua is cheaper than treating her. Does that actually happen?
Yes, that happens. That happens.
That's stunning.
Yeah, well, in L.A., I mean, we've had the cases of patients being dropped on the street.
Granny dumping.
Right.
And they do it in front of cameras. I mean, how stupid do you have to be to do a thing like that?
Yeah.
Is it just they're so desperate or so mean that they do that?
You know, I'd like to say it was that simple and that black and white. I don't think most of the people involved. You also have to consider there are no beds in some of these hospitals. They need beds for patients that are being admitted. They're running out of money. Some of these hospitals are going broke. So obviously it's a cruel and inhumane decision and wrong, clearly wrong. But I think to just simplify it as cruelty is not to look at the source of the problem.
But what's the first commandment of a doctor?
Yeah.
Do no harm. Well, I mean, how can you know, leaving a senile, incontinent old person in a wheelchair on a public street, that's got to be doing harm.
Completely. It is. You're right.
Okay. what are you working on now?
I'm starting my third novel. So it
medical?
Is it's still medically based. I don't know that I'll always write medically based novels, but this one combines a physician's point of view with a patient's point of view and goes into really a completely different direction. Doesn't have any of the same characters in my first two books, but there's so many stories to come out of medicine. And each time I think maybe I should veer away, I just, you know, something hooks me back in to talk about.
You sound like Al Pacino in The Godfather, you know, try to get out and they just draw me back up. Have you ever thought of writing a totally cool medical thriller, you know, something, it's outside your comfort zone maybe, but has that ever occurred to you?
It's occurred to me. In fact, this book started out as much more of a medical thriller, but it doesn't seem to be in my nature, at least at this moment, because I keep
wanting to
soften things. Yeah, throw in, maybe that's what it is, throw in a little more nuance or descriptive something that takes me off the beaten path. So, but someday I might do it. I don't know. It seems like it might be fun.
The relationship between Addison and Claire gets damaged a lot
and
over the course of their relationship. And even when they try to be tender to each other, sometimes it just doesn't work. And this struck me as so much like the way a real marriage operates. Mm. Is this in your experience? I don't want to ask you anything really personal about this, but because everybody knows people that this has happened to, but this was so specific.
Sure. Well, I've been married 20 years, and I don't think you can be married more than – well, I'll take it past 6 months. But if you've been married 20 years, you're going to go through spells. You're going to go through periods where you just feel completely frustrated and at odds with your spouse. I think most people do. And to me, a lot of what needs to be happening in a good, solid marriage is that you're choosing to stick it through those battles. And I think this economic downturn has had huge impact on families, on relationships.
Money is always the big thing.
It is. We like to think it's not. You know, we all got married, or many of my friends in particular, artists, got married when they were young. It was fine to live on a shoestring, do what you like, don't worry about money. The money will come, and the money doesn't always come. And then you figure out, hey, kids really need shoes, and the shoes are really not cheap. And it can become a hugely tense point within any relationship, I think. So
yeah. The other thing I liked about their relationship is they're not above pushing each other's buttons.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you can only hurt people you love, and that's because you know just where to stick the knife. So
yeah.
It's an interesting book, and politically, I think it would interest the KBOO audience. So they believe everything that you believe. Okay. I'd like to remind you once more, the title of the book is Healer, Carol Casella, CASSELLA, published by Simon & Schuster. Please come back again.
I'd love to, Ed. Thank you very much.